From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We hope you enjoyed the Independence Day holiday. It made for a short week on the show.
Yeah, let's open with one of our favorite recent moments on Connections. We had a conversation about adoption. Specifically, it was about open records. The New York State Assembly passed legislation to provide adult adoptees with access to their birth certificates, health records, and identifying information about their birth families. But the bill has been stalled repeatedly due to concerns about confidentiality. The desire for families to have access to information, though, has led many people to pursue open adoptions, where biological and adoptive families communicate with and even visit each other.
Laura Glasner is the adoption director for Jewish Family Service of Rochester, and she and her husband adopted their daughter, Nora, at birth through an open adoption. Midway through the show, we got a call from Nora, much to the surprise of her mom. Here she is, sharing her adoption story and how she embraces her adoptive status.
This is Nora in Los Angeles. Why are you laughing,
hi,
Nora?
Hi, Evan.
Hi, Nora. She said, hi, Mom.
Hi, sweetie.
Oh, great.
That's a surprise.
Well, you know, you were talking about the stigma surrounding adoption, the age at which so many adoptees are able to legally find this information. You know, I don't remember ever being explicitly told that I was adopted. It was just information that was always there for me. And my parents really left it up to me to decide when I was ready to meet my biological family. And for me, that time was when I was 7. So that, you know, it's pretty young. But, you know, developmentally, I felt I was ready to meet the people who created me. And, you know, I had this wonderful support of my adoptive parents to have a relationship with my biological family. And that's been really a defining thing in my life. My adopted status is part of my identity, and it's something that I'm proud of. And it's the openness and the relationship that I've had with both sides of my family and that they've had with each other that I think is directly responsible for, you know, for that feeling of pride and that feeling of not having to question my identity, because I can ask the questions of both sides and I can get answers and I can be close to both sides without feeling like I'm missing a part of myself. So I think the openness is really an incredible thing that I've had in my life and something that I really wish for other adopted children and adults to experience. Hmm.
Nora, stay there. I'm going to let your mom respond to some of what she just heard from you.
I'm verklempt.
Those are beautiful sentiments, Laura. I mean, to me, I'm not adopted in a family with adoption, and I don't want to be judgmental. I don't want different people feel different ways, and I certainly don't want to be judgmental. But I do think there's a beauty in what I'm hearing from Nora, your daughter, who's saying, you know, you gave her this opportunity, and she decided when she was ready. It happened to be at a pretty early age, but that was, you know, Nora, do you almost look at that as a gift from your family, that they were willing to, they didn't want to shroud it from you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's been a gift that's been there my whole life, and I'm so blessed to have the relationship with my birth mother and my birth family that I do, and it's entirely because my parents were so willing and open to expand their family to not only include me, but include the people from where I came. So yeah, it's been amazing.
Laura, was there any hesitation, or hesitation's the wrong word, anxiety on your part about ever getting in contact, whether you were going to have to meet the birth family, and how,
well,
what was that like?
We had met prior to Nora being born, and then we maintained contact, you know, consistently. So it wasn't like we, you know, there was a gap.
Okay.
I mean, it was something that was growing. You know, like any relationship, it grows, mm-hmm. and changes, and so, of course. I think when we went there when Nora was 7, there was a little twinge, but it was so much overshadowed by the joy, really, of being able to be a part of this incredible connection. And there's really never been, I've never had a moment of regret that, you know, that this was the nature of our adoptive relationship. Mm. And we chose this was an independent adoption, which is possible to do legally in New York. And one of the reasons why we did that was because of the possibility of having a real relationship with birth parents.
Next up, how friendship can help reduce the stigma of mental illness. Nearly 44 million American adults experience mental illness in a given year, but only about 60% receive treatment. The stigma surrounding mental illness keeps many adults and youth from asking for help.
CompUSA Rochester runs volunteer matching programs where people struggling with mental health issues are paired with members of the community. CompUSA says there are therapeutic benefits in friendship, and Steve Smock agrees. He was struggling with thoughts of suicide when he was matched with Jim Sedita, a CompUSA volunteer. And in this clip, Steve talks about how his friendship with Jim saved his life.
I was a troubled child, born into trouble, an abusive household, and my first psychiatrist was at 8 years old in Canandaigua. I grew up in Canandaigua. That's where it all started for me in childhood. And in teenage years, it was a troubled youth. I got sent away. I was a teenage criminal. I got into drugs and alcohol, rock and roll, you know, just the sex and drugs, and just rebellion and rage. I had so much rage and anger.
Can I ask you, about, as you're kind of flying through your story here, and but when you say rage, were you, did you feel angry at everything? Was it directed in any certain way?
It was at my dad, and but anyways, I want to talk about the stigma.
Sure.
I looked it up in the dictionary before, and in solutions. I want to talk about solutions because I'm 60 years old, and I've had a long history of mental illness, severe, homeless all over the country, jails, institutions, facilities, just the horror, the hellish, tormented, tortured life that I just want to educate and speak to all the listening audience. That we're sons and daughters, and we have, just like the doctor was saying, that we're human beings too, and we have emotions and we have feelings, and we're and the loving, the solution for me, the stigma means, I looked it up in the dictionary, it means disgrace and discredit. And going, you know, and without that help, I started getting help through CompUSA, my match, Jim. And that was the culmination 9 years ago. We've been together for 9 years. And then with the Veteran Outreach Center, with the art therapy and the combination, then being clean and sober for over 4+ years, and the combination of the CompUSA match and our long, loving relationship. It's about love and kindness and hope for a mentally and emotionally well life. And coming to that through a lot of hard work on my part, to get the demons out of me, and it, you know, in the spiritual aspect, the solution for me, the mental wellness and the emotional wellness and the physical wellness, and it's the fundamental in the spiritual wellness, the spiritual significance with our Creator for me, and the spiritual aspect, getting right with God, who God sees me, my thoughts and stuff, and so the solution, I'm restored back to my youthful exuberance and my outgoing extroverted sense of humor. I love life. I have a lot of loving outside the box, cutting edge, CompUSA included, Veteran Outreach Center, Battle Buddies with the VOC, and CompUSA Corps. It's just been a wonderful experience for me. I love life and I love being here in this opportunity.
Congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
And I know it's a lot of work. When did you said you got in touch with CompUSA for the first time? Was it
about 9 years ago.
About 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And subsequently, in the last 4 to 5 years, he's come full circle. He's made a full circle. I mean, it's unbelievable.
What's the biggest difference you see?
The biggest difference? Well, for one, he doesn't imbibe or, you know, do drugs or what he used to do. He was arrested at one point when I knew him before he got, so to say, better. And
sober, yeah.
Yeah, and... You know, he did. I remember we were sitting on the International Bridge across the river, you know, downtown Rochester, and I was talking about a suicide. I really did. I mean, he listened, and he said, you know, it worked.
Well, so Steve, for you, what do you remember about meeting Jim? And did you want that? Did you want to open up to somebody?
Well, Evan, it was a long journey, very painful journey, step by step. I was hard-headed, pig-headed, stubborn, and you know, I just knew I was so desperate for help to emotionally and mentally have a balance, and the match CompUSA provided that initial stage, And no, I wasn't there. No, I was still resistant. I just was searching for that inner peace. And Compere provided that bridge, that first step to a mental and emotional wellness.
Finally, the small newspaper that won the biggest award in journalism. This year, the Pulitzer Prize Committee selected several small newspapers for outstanding investigative work, including the Storm Lake Times in Iowa, the smallest paper ever to win.
We talked to Art Cullen, the editorial writer. Wait until you hear this guy. Art is the kind of journalist who just does not care what people in power think of him. The Pulitzer Committee said that his writing was based on excellent reporting and insight, and he successfully took on Big Ag. Cullen's work is the kind you might find in just about any community, standing up for the little guy, challenging big corporate interests who trample the law, and he also called out the local lawmakers who allowed it to happen. So we first asked him how those lawmakers liked his writing.
Well, they, you know, spit nails. They didn't invite me to their Thanksgiving dinner and or their holiday party, but that's all right. But the argument in the court case was essentially over, shall agriculture be regulated as a point source polluter, just as a municipal sewage plant is? And so the verdict is no, there is no way to regulate agricultural runoff. So agriculture is free to fertilize as it will, where it will. So that's the status quo. What our role was is we at least were able to explain it to the public and demonstrate to the public that we have a problem here and that the terms of the conversation are starting to change in that Governor Terry Branstad, a Farm Bureau Republican, proposed a multi-billion dollar fund to clean up Iowa's surface waters. Now that fund failed to materialize in the legislature. But it just shows that the conversation has been changing in Iowa and that we are becoming at least aware and acknowledging that we have a problem and that we are polluting the Gulf of Mexico. And so at least we're starting to pay attention to it, which is better than what we could have said 10 years ago.
Well, and I got to know here, I mean, how does the Pulitzer Committee let you know that you won?
Well, there was a live stream on the Pulitzer website at Pulitzer.org and on April 10th, and I was aware that they would have this live stream at 2 p.m. And so I just tuned in on my computer here in the office, and they announced the winners to the public at that time, and that was when I found out that we won.
And what was your reaction at that moment?
Is this taped?
This is pre-recorded, yes.
Yeah, so anyway, there's 21 journalism categories, and editorial writing was number 18. And so, you know, they're going through with the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, ProPublica, the New York Daily News, Chicago Tribune. And then they say, Peggy Noonan for commentary from the Wall Street Journal. And then there's number 18 is editorial writing. And as they said, Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times. And I sprung out of my chair and screamed, holy s***, and to my brother John. And I said, we won. And John said, what did we win? I said, we won the freaking Pulitzer. And John hugged each other, and I hugged each other for the first time in our lives, I think.
Well, Art, before we get into just a short conversation about what it was that you were writing about that the Pulitzer Committee thought was so important, I do want to ask you if you agree with some of the sentiment that I've been reading since you're winning this prize. Some have pointed to you and, you know, a few other publications as examples that the Pulitzer Committee knows that this country needs print journalism as a kind of watchdog, as a kind of support for communities, especially small communities, and that this is a validation of sort of the necessity of that work. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure if I do, because that would imply that the Pulitzer Board was sort of making a political decision, and I don't think that that's the case.
Okay.
What I think, I mean, small newspapers, I believe we might be the smallest newspaper ever to win a Pulitzer. I'm not sure, but I think so. Environmental issues are also a really hot topic in America right now. And, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement and all that. And so maybe our editorial writing entry just happened to hit on those themes that are big to America. And it involved dark money in politics, in the court system, and conflict between urban and rural areas, and so it had all the kind of the recipe for an award-winning entry.
And that does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. And fortunately, you didn't hear any of the bloopers from this week's podcast.
This was a particularly bloopy one.
It was.
Bloopery?
That's a new adjective.
Bloopy?
Bloopy?
Bloopered?
Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.
Bloop, bloop, bloop.